Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. The Green Bay Packers had a fairly successful 2024 season, I think anyway, but like all teams, plenty of room for improvement. And the easiest way to improve an NFL team is through the draft. And our first guest today, Pete Doherty, is going to talk about the draft. Pete's a Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's covered the Packers since 1993, and he attended the NFL draft over the weekend right outside Lambeau Field. And he'll be with us up until about 11:45 today. And we want to hear from you. How did you feel about the Packers draft? Do you think the moves made to improve the team? And if you attended the draft, I'd really like to hear from you. What was that experience like? Did the city rise to the occasion? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Pete Doherty, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
Did you survive? How'd you survive the draft this year? I mean, it was in your own backyard compared to every other year.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I thought it was going to overwhelm the city, but it really didn't. You know, the daily life stuff was away from the stadium. There was the traffic here. There were no issues with anything like that. And the actual covering the draft, if you cover the team and you cover the draft, it was no different than any other draft. They have a media auditorium at their facilities over there at Lambeau. And that's where, if you're in the media, that's where you spend the draft, because they put the draft up on a TV screen and they bring down the GM, a couple of scouts, the head coach over the 3 days of the draft to talk about the picks. So that part of it wasn't any different. And getting to and from the stadium, I thought it was going to be a nightmare.
Yeah,
and it was really no different than a game day. In fact, it was probably even not quite as crowded as a game day. And game days are fine over there. They've got it down to a science. So overall, it just it was not that much different for me. And it sounds like it was a really good experience for a lot of people there. I had people staying in my neighborhood. I was walking my dog and bumped into people and just asked them what it was like over there. And it sounded like it was really well organized, and people had a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think they did. I heard an account that the all the folks who were trying to sell parking were having a problem because people were finding on-street parking, which was amazing to at least the people I talked to.
Yeah, they have that. That's available for games, too. But you could see as you were driving in the neighborhoods there, as I got close to the stadium, you could see where they'd crossed out the prices, you know, and they were dropping as the day was going on, especially on Friday and Saturday.
Oh, well, I watched it on TV a little more than I normally do, just because it was in Green Bay, and I sort of wanted to see how it looked, and then the response from the television commentators, I was interested in that, and it was all very positive. Very positive.
Yeah, I think, you know, I would have thought this was going to be just a one-time thing. I wouldn't be surprised if I have no idea. There's probably going to end up being a rotation for draft cities, you know, kind of like there is for Super Bowls. I wonder if that's how it's going to go. And if there is, I got to think Green Bay would be on the rotation if it wants to be. It just sounds like overall it was a really good experience for most people. I'm sure there were hitches here and there, but everything I've seen is that it was, you know, I've seen some quotes from people who attended the Detroit draft last year, and they thought this one was more fun, was better, a little better organized.
Yeah, I think it's in Pittsburgh next year. Somebody was letting me know. So, well, let's talk about the Packers, what they actually did over the weekend, and maybe go back a bit. In your mind, the team's biggest needs heading into the draft?
So I thought their biggest needs were, you know, pass rusher anywhere on the D-line and defensive tackle overall. But definitely edge rusher too. I thought those were there was the biggest that was the biggest need, but really close, like almost indistinguishable after that was cornerback and receiver. I did think that they would end up, I was pretty sure they'd end up drafting either a defensive lineman or defensive tackle or defensive end on the first 2 days. And so that was a surprise they didn't. But, Brian Gutekunst has come up in this system, especially, working for Ted Thompson, where you don't force something that's not there and you don't make bad trades to try to get something you need. And you go by your board, and they did need receiver too, and they've changed, their approach a little bit. I mean, I think they theoretically, if they pick two good players, they were high picks, first and third round, they should be a more dangerous, dynamic, offensive team this year, and they play in a division with a lot of good offense and a lot of offensive talent. So, I'm sure part of what they thought was they just, especially with how their passing offense kind of collapsed those last 3 weeks of the season. I'm sure part of their thinking is they needed to get more dynamic on offense to get more help for Jordan Love. And so they drafted to do that. Now, whether they accomplish it will depend on whether these guys turn out to be good. And, we don't know that till they start playing games.
Yeah. Well, you've got Matthew Golden, I think, in the first round. And then the third rounder was Savion Williams, I think, from TCU.
Yep. With Golden's fast. He ran 4.29, which anything under 4.3 is blazing fast. And I would think he would help them right away, if for no other reason than he can stretch defenses. And you got a shade of safety his way for the deep route stuff. But they also really liked how well he caught the ball. They thought he had as good a hands, maybe the best hands of anybody in this draft. And anybody following the Packers knows that last season that they had some pretty serious drop problems. So, he should help them at a decent amount right away. 50 catches, 60 catches for a rookie is a pretty solid season. And Williams will be interesting because he's raw as far as a route runner and all that. But he was a guy that TCU just they tried to get him the ball. They played him at Wildcat quarterback some. They lined him up in the backfield. They threw bubble screens to him. They just wanted the ball in his hands. He's a huge receiver, 6'3" and a half and like 222. That's a very big receiver. And he's good with the ball in his hands. At least he was in college. Matt LaFleur made it sound like he wants to, he's going to, they're going to design some ways to get the ball in this guy's hands. So even though he's not, he's an unsophisticated route runner, there's still ways to get help from him. The Packers like to do jet sweep stuff and fake jet sweeps, so I suspect we'll see him in that role some. And I don't know. I think this offense is going to look a little different than I would have guessed. Even a week ago with this, it'll probably look a little different than I was thinking it would.
Yeah, I agree. I would think Jordan Love had a big smile on his face.
Yeah, it's funny. Ron Wolf always said at the end of Brett Favre's career, when after Wolf retired actually in 2000, he always said he'd wished he'd done a little more to give Favre more weapons. And he said that enough. I'm sure he said that with his staff. I'm sure he said it to Ted Thompson, and Brian Gutekunst was around all during that time, and I'm sure he heard that too. So I suspect that that message hit home with him too, because Gutekunst hit receiver heavy a couple of years ago. And a year ago at this time, it looked like those guys were on the rise, and a couple of them, leveled off last season, and so they're reloading again. And I'll be interested to see. They were, I think, seventh or eighth in the league in scoring last season, and I'll be curious to see if they pop into the top five this year.
Yeah, it was kind of fun. I was watching on television when Mark Murphy got to the dais, and it was his first time in his life in his position with the Packers that they were able to pick the receiver in the first round. It was pretty cool. Somebody else said there was just a huge roar when he made the pick. You couldn't quite hear it as much on television.
Yeah, It's always, fans and people who watch the game a lot, they always love seeing offensive skill players drafted because that stuff is exciting. Now, the Packers have had a lot of good receivers who weren't picked in the first round, who, if you reheld those drafts, 4 years later, they would have gotten picked in the first round. Guys like Jordy Nelson and Greg Jennings and Davante Adams. So they've been really successful picking guys in the second round, receivers in the second round and even later. But you're still your odds. Odds of missing on a pick are pretty high, even in the first round. I mean, more guys are average or barely above or below average than they are really good. But your odds are still better to hit on a really good player the higher you pick them. And so I'll be really curious to see how Matthew Golden looks and if he's ready to play from day one.
Yeah, and I think also, didn't we get a big offensive lineman too?
Yeah, Anthony Belton from North Carolina State, 330 something, 335, I think. 6'6" and a half, something like that. I mean, that is a huge man. And Brian Gutekunst says he says over and over again, football is a big man's game. And they don't strictly do this, but they generally like to pick guys who, no matter what their position, the guy is big for players at his position. Golden is kind of an exception. He's definitely not a big receiver, but he had the distinguishing trait of the great speed. But they had, anybody who watched that Philadelphia game could see how the Packers got kind of overwhelmed on both lines. And Philadelphia did it to everybody, overwhelmed on both sides of the line of scrimmage. And it is a big man's game. I'm sure this isn't the last that we'll see of Gutekunst drafting, behemoth guys like that.
Pete Doherty, our guest today, Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network, Wisconsin. It's great to have him with us today as we talk about the Packers and the draft. I hope you'll join in with your own thoughts and comments. If you attended the draft, I'd love to hear from you. Or if you have a question about the Packers and maybe the Packers picks, give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at the NFL draft today. Just to let you know, coming up at 11:45, we talked with Janelle Dethridge, a former professional and collegiate runner at the UW-Madison. We'll talk with her about how to train for a marathon. And then at 12:30, John Martin, one of our weather guys, is back to talk about the kind of weather we'll see over the second half of spring here in Wisconsin. But right now, Pete Doherty's with us. Pete, as I mentioned, Packers columnist for the Green Bay Press Gazette and USA Today Network, Wisconsin. Give a call. Were you at the draft or do you have a question about the Packers? Give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. Well, let's see. Were there any picks that left you scratching your head?
At first, when they picked Savion Williams in the third round, I was kind of shocked, because, like I said, I expected them to, get somebody on the defensive line in the first three rounds. I would have bet a fair amount on that, but it's just a good reminder, and I should be chastising myself for doing that. You just never know what's going to happen in the draft. And, they're not going to, Gutekunst isn't going to force picks or make what he thinks is a bad trade to fill a spot. So he's going to go by the board. And the needs were big enough at all those positions where, the four that we talked about earlier, where if they went receiver twice, I shouldn't have been as surprised as I was. But I have to admit, I was surprised. There were no picks where I was like, what are they doing here? This is ridiculous. But that's pretty rare because I've learned enough doing this 30 some years that to make any judgments about the draft and about a specific pick just based on, whether you think the guy's going to be good or not is fruitless because, even they don't know, and they spend, a year preparing for each draft, and they know a lot about these guys, and even with the teams, they don't know if they're going to be good. I mean, how many times do you see where a fourth round pick is better than a first round pick? It happens often enough. So I've learned to just not make too many judgments about who they pick, and just wait and see how it plays out, because you just don't know, and people who do that for a living don't even know.
Yeah, you can think about some of the great quarterbacks, really good ones that did not go in the first round. Maybe the best quarterback ever, or certainly one of the best ever. And last
Yeah,
year,
he was pick. Well, he's a six. He was pick 199, I think, and Bart Starr was pick 200 of his draft, or vice versa. They were one pick apart, basically. And yeah, you don't know, and the teams don't know. And it's still, for all the information they have, and they have a ton of it, and for all the background research they do, and they do a ton of that, there's still, very much, it's as much art as science in picking these guys.
yeah. Tim in Madison emailed. He was watching on TV the opening of the draft process and thought it sounded like the commissioner was being booed. Was that true? And if so, why would the crowd boo him?
Oh yeah, he got booed mercilessly, but that's the case every year, and
Yeah.
he does just what he did there, where he encourages it and tells people to bring it on. No, that was not a unique to Green Bay thing. Basically, a big part of Roger Goodell's job, and one of the reasons he makes $50 million a year, whatever it is he stands out front and takes all the abuse for the owners, so they don't take it. That's part of his job. Is, they call the NFL the shield, the NFL logo. Well, Roger Goodell is the owner's shield, and so that's part of his job.
I thought it was interesting. There was a great story about a guy who wasn't going to be picked in the early rounds, who went to the green room anyway. He made his way to Green Bay, and he actually did get picked. Blanking on his name suddenly.
Yeah, Sorrell, the linebacker. He was the first edge rusher that they took, and he was their fourth round pick. And it's funny, they didn't even the Packers, the GM, the coach, everybody in their draft room, they didn't know he was there. He was not on the list of people who were supposed to be there. I mean, he wasn't, even in consideration for anybody for a first round pick. He came in because he thought he might get picked in the third round, and he just wanted to be there, and so he came in and he decided to stay over till Friday. And that's why Goodell actually announced his when he was picked, he never announces picks on the third day of the draft, but because this guy stuck around, he made a point of going out there and announcing the pick. And I was just at the gym yesterday and was talking with an acquaintance, and he was saying, how cool he thought that was, that the guy was there and the fan re I mean, this guy has just he's become a fan favorite without even stepping on the field or without even doing anything. And people, I guarantee you, Packers fans had not heard of this guy until that day. So he's off to a good start as far as being a really popular guy in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. And then I guess in the little press conference afterwards, he kind of broke down talking about his mom and his dad. And I mean, you couldn't have asked for better theater than that whole situation.
Yeah, because usually when they always when they do these draft picks, they they're not in Green Bay. So what they do is, after the pick, within about 15 or 20 minutes, they get the guy on a phone call or a Zoom call for the media who are sitting in the auditorium. So that's the first exposure. And even with Golden, he was over, he was one of the guys who came for the first round. They did not bring him over. And I think it was by NFL rules that those guys coming in could not go over to the Packers facility. So they didn't even bring him in, but they were able to, I guess because it was after the first day, they were able to with this guy, but he came in, he had probably five or six or seven family members. So that's, it's just, you just never see that where they're there at a press conference and they were sitting in the front row. And yeah, when he was asked to identify him, he just he had a little trouble even, you know, saying their names. It took probably 4 or 5 minutes for him to go through everybody. It just tells you how, you know, what this means to these people who, you know, they spend a lot of their lives, you know, dreaming of this and preparing for it. And you know, when it actually hits, even if they don't expect it, it really hits them hard.
Well, he was an edge rusher, right? Out of Texas.
Yeah, out of Texas. Yeah, and he it sounds like he's a guy who everybody at the program really liked having around. Just a good guy to have in your locker room. And you know, obviously the most important thing is whether you can play or not. But loving football and being a good teammate and all that, it can matter in evaluations, and it sounds like it mattered in his.
Yeah, it sure does. What was, somebody has a question here about the economic impact for Green Bay. It's got to be pretty good, I would think.
I would think so too. There was a lot of people from out of town. There, my next door neighbor, you know, has a flat in his back and had some people in from Minnesota staying there. I trying to remember the numbers. I think the estimates were that it was going to be about 90 million extra economic activity for the state as a whole and about 20 million for Green Bay. You know, they're doing surveys, and the results of that won't be out for a couple months, so we won't know the real, or you know, have a better estimate until those come out. I think they, you know, the attendance was really high. Now, the way they keep attendance keeps this murky, because if you walked into the, you know, it's free to get in, so if you walked in to the campus and then you left and then you came back a little later, you're counted twice. And if you came one, even just once all 3 days, you're counted three times. So that 600,000 number is deceiving, but it's still pretty high. And so there had to have been a, you know, a pretty high number of unique visitors, which, you know, and you know, a lot of them had to come from at least outside of Green Bay. I think a lot of people from around Wisconsin probably made day trips out of it. But we'll find out the real numbers. But considering they were thinking more along the lines of, you know, 300,000 or so, I wonder if those economic impact numbers might be a little low. I guess you know, we'll find out when the survey comes out.
Yeah, and you wonder how many were outside of Wisconsin, let's say. You know, was it 70% Wisconsin folks and 30%, you know, all the other teams? Or, you know, of course we have no way of knowing.
Yeah, there's not. You know, there were. I saw driver's license. I saw car licenses from, you know, all over the country, and there were obviously people wearing, you know, I was just walking around, you know, going into the stadium. There were people wearing, you know, every jersey in the league. So, you know, I'm sure there were a lot of visitors who came in for it. But I, you know, yeah, you're right. You know, who knows whether it was 30-70 or, you know, 20-80. Who knows?
I think it was kind of a nice send off for Packers CEO and President Mark Murphy. I personally like him a lot. I had a chance to spend quite a bit of time with him when I was in Green Bay for an event. And he's just a, to me, a really genuine and nice person. And I was happy. He's retiring in July, so this is his swan song. What was your impression of Mark Murphy?
You know, he was a big mover in getting the draft here. I think he was the one, as much as anybody in that organization, who first grabbed onto the idea and thought it was something that the Packers could do and that Green Bay and Brown County could do. Overall, I mean, look, he's got his detractors. Everybody does. You know, you know, there's things that they could have done better. They've had these great quarterbacks. There is some truth in, you know, you have Favre and Rodgers back to back. Winning two Super Bowls feels a little light because those guys are, you know, first ballot Hall of Famers, and Murphy was in charge for a decent chunk of that.
Yeah.
But they've also won. I looked this up a few weeks ago. I can't remember the exact numbers, but if you go back to when Ron Wolf was hired in '92, they have, it's either the best record or the second best record in football. So that's winning a lot of games, and you're in contention, and so your fans always have a reason to be engaged. And they've he presided over an organization where, they had a Hall of Fame quarterback who said he wanted to keep playing, and they drafted another quarterback anyway. And there's a lot of owners around this league who would not have allowed the Packers to who have not allowed their teams to draft Jordan Love. If they had had Aaron Rodgers as their quarterback, they would have said, no, we're taking a guy who's going to help us now. And Love sat 3 years. And, I think that's kind of one of the Packers' superpowers is they allow for their GM to make the football decisions. And to make a long-term decision like that, you take a lot of criticism from fans, the people who pay the bills. You take a lot of criticism for doing something like that, and it's paid off. It's looking like it's going to pay off, at least fairly well, and maybe better than that. And just like it paid off great with Rodgers, with Favre to Rodgers. So a long way of getting to that. He's presided over a lot of good football and the expansion of all that. So overall, I mean, it's hard, whether you like him or not. I think it's hard to say that, his tenure hasn't been, pretty successful.
Yeah, I would agree. We haven't talked. I mean, I want to go back to the Packers picks for a minute because they did go to defense on their fifth and sixth picks. I think they didn't they use defensive lineman. Who was it? Colin Oliver, somebody like that, from Oklahoma State.
Yeah, he was their fifth round pick, and he's another edge rusher. I think, and what's really interesting with him is, so Brian Gutekunst really likes these edge rushers, these edge guys, ideally to be, 6'5", 265 to 270. That basically describes Rashawn Gary, who was a first round pick a few years ago, Lucas Van Ness, who was a first round pick 2 years ago. That's his prototype for that position. Even when they sign undrafted guys or they draft guys later, they're usually at least, 255 at the kind of at the minimum. And, a lot of them are 260, 265. And he likes to have those big edge guys, playing in Green Bay in the winter, just to hold the edge against the run. If people get hurt, he always says, if you have a small edge rusher and you lose a couple guys, the small edge rusher has to start playing more and on rundowns, and then, you start getting attacked there. And the interesting thing with Oliver is he's 240. That's really small for an edge guy, and it's a concession that they needed a little more speed. At least they wanted take a chance and have at least one speed rusher, for getting after the quarterback. And they basically said this guy, at least early in his career, if he's a good player, will be a designated pass rusher, somebody they'll rotate in there on third and 8 or maybe second and really long. That's a guy who'll be in there in passing downs, and his job will be to get after the quarterback.
Yeah. And they also got George's Warren Brinson of as well. He was pretty late.
Yes, yeah, sixth rounder, I believe, and that's getting later in the draft. Those guys, the failure rate increases each round you move down. But sixth rounders can end up being good player. I mean, as we said, Tom Brady was a sixth rounder.
Yeah.
So, but they lost T.J. Slaton, who was their best, pure run stopping defensive lineman. They let him walk in free agency. So they needed to fill that. This guy isn't as big as Slayton. He's a little better rusher than Slayton was coming out of college. He's not as big and powerful as Slayton, so he's probably not quite the run stopper. But they needed to add to that defensive line room after losing Slayton. So, it's just anybody's guess, one on whether this guy will be, a good enough player to keep around for the, 4 years of his rookie contract, and two, whether he's good enough to, actually help them and be part of the rotation this season.
We had, well, the 7 rounds, we had 8 picks. How did we get eight, wind up with 8 picks? Do you remember that last?
Yeah, so in with free agency, they with the players they lost versus the players they gained, you get. You can get draft picks if you lost more than you gained. Now I've got a, I sorry, I don't know this off the top of my head, Larry, but I can't remember if that's how they got their other seventh rounder, or if it was from a trade last year. It also could be that.
Oh
I'm
yeah.
sorry, I just can't remember off the top of my head right now.
I don't remember either. I was thinking about the Badger football team and the picks, the most of the picks were from former Badgers who had left NIL wise or otherwise.
Yeah, it was, they wanted to make it a state of Wisconsin thing, to appeal to, because I'm sure they knew fans were going to be here from all over the state, so they wanted to appeal to everybody. So yeah, there were a ton of former Badgers up there. Even there was Tim Krumrie, who I think he was a player when I was going to school down in Madison.
I was so upset when the Packers didn't pick him when they had the chance to let him go because I thought he was the best player. And he
Oh,
had,
they should have. He's in the Hall of Fame. That he would have helped them a lot.
I was thinking about other teams. Cleveland. Now you wonder about Cleveland because they're sitting now, if I'm not mistaken, with 5 quarterbacks. If you
Yeah,
add them all up.
you can't take that many into training camp because there's just not enough snaps to go around for all of them. You got to get your starter the majority of the work, and your backup's got to get his share of work too. So I mean, they're for sure going to cut one, and they may even, I wonder if they'll reduce down to three before training camp is over. But yeah, that whole Shedeur Sanders story was really amazing to see him drop from, where a lot of people, I mean, Mel Kiper had him as what, his third best player. And I'm sure, there were teams out there. I'm guessing there were teams out there that, had a first round grade on him, even if they weren't going to pick him. But to see him be available still in the fifth round, that was really interesting. I'll be curious to see if he ends up, if the league is right with their evaluation of him, and that he was drafted where he should have been, or if he ends up being a good player.
You just wonder about his dad and what the maybe the negative impact his dad might have had on the whole the view of him.
Yeah, if you're running a team and you think, well, he's not bad. He's maybe he'll be good, maybe he'll be a starter, but I'm not sold on it. Do you want him on your team? And if your starter's struggling, to have his dad, if his dad ever says anything, it's going to make national news, and he's not afraid to say what he's thinking. There might be some teams that just didn't want to deal with that, especially if you're a coach or a GM who's, you feel like you're a little bit on the hot seat. You wouldn't want to deal with that, and you might think it would be a problem for your locker room too. So I don't doubt for a second that played at least a part in it.
Yeah. Somebody else is wondering, how does character play into who gets drafted or not? How important is it to the Packers to draft players who they think fit their team's culture?
It matters for all teams. It matters for some more than others. My experience observing the Packers is it's through the three GMs, the three main GMs that I've covered, is that it seems to matter a little more with them than the rest of the league. But it's sort of a sliding scale where how good a player you are, they'll put up with more. They'll take higher risks. And then there's two sides of character. There's whether someone's prone to getting in trouble off the field, and there's football character. Is how much do you love the game? How hard do you work? How hard do you practice? Are you a good guy to have around in the locker room? That's all would be grouped into football character, and it seems like that matters quite a bit.
Yeah, I think you're right. I've had occasion to be a professor for some first rounders, and I had I remember fielding calls from the NFL itself about the character of the person because I was their advisor
What
and.
kind of questions would they ask you?
What was he like in the classroom? What was his, what did you observe outside the classroom? How did he relate to other students? Were there issues, with that you saw with respect that he gave to you, to me, or to others? Especially other women in the to women in the classes, things like that.
Was this scouts from teams, or was this somebody from the league office? I'm
League
guessing it was
office,
scouts, right?
league office.
Oh, okay.
I think scouts too on occasion, but I didn't have that many, but the few I had stand out in my mind a bit. So. Those were the kinds of questions. Well, what do you think? Overall, you happy with the end result for the Packers?
Like I said earlier, I learned fairly early on covering this league that to make any judgments just based on name recognition or even, I talked to a handful of scouts about these guys, especially the guys going in the first couple rounds, and you wouldn't believe how the evaluations of a guy, one scout will say one thing and one scout will think almost the exact opposite about the guy. One scout will love a guy, another scout will just be, yeah, I just don't see it with this guy. So I've learned a lot enough to not make any judgments about whether a player is good or not. You can make judgments about did they take a big injury risk with this guy? Is he coming off an injury? Did he have injury problems? Things like that. Those things are open to wondering about as far as I'm concerned. But was it a good draft? Was it not? Who knows?
On that
Not very
note,
satisfying, but
yeah.
that's kind of the way it is.
Pete, thanks a lot for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it. I hope we can do this again down the road. Thanks, Pete.
Yeah, sure, anytime, Larry. Thank you for having me.
Pete Doherty is a great guest to have on the show. He's been covering the Packers for a long, long time and knows a whole lot about what's going on. It's great to have him with us. Coming up, we're going to take a look at marathons. You want to be a marathon runner, or are you one already? You'll have a chance to talk with our expert guest next. I'm Larry Mueller. Well, you know what? It's estimated that each year over 1 million people run at least one marathon. And if you've ever considered being one of those million, you've got a lot of opportunities to do so right here in Wisconsin. But you can't just wake up one day and decide to run 26.2 miles. Getting your body ready for that kind of prolonged activity takes some training. Larry Mueller here for WPR News. And we've got some great tips to get you started on that training with our next guest, Janelle Dethridge. Janelle is a physical therapist with UW Health Sports Medicine Runners Clinic. She's also a five-time Olympic trials qualifier, as well as a four-time All-American for the UW-Madison Badgers track and cross-country teams. So as we talk with Janelle Dethridge, I hope you'll join in. Are you a runner trying to work your way up to a marathon? What's holding you back? Or have you run a marathon but weren't happy with how it went? You can give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Janelle Dethridge, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you fill us in a bit on your running background? How did you get started running, and tell us, you know, give us sort of the various stages of your running career?
Oh, you're making me go way back. yeah, absolutely. I started running when I was probably about 10, mostly because my dad was a marathon runner, and I did a couple runs with him and found that I had some talent, and just kind of blossomed from there. I ran in middle school, and then in high school, and had some pretty good success, and then was fortunate enough to get a scholarship to come here and run for the Badgers, which was an incredible experience, and had a lot of amazing teammates, and we won some Big Ten titles, and that just spurred a professional career. So I continued to run throughout physical therapy school, and then ran professionally for a brief period of time, and then kind of transitioned to the marathon after my professional career was over. So that's, you know, the kind of the last phase here. I feel like the older we get, the longer we go. So, but it's been really enjoyable. And I think treating runners in the clinic has really helped me, you know, connect with my patients, just having, you know, shared experience.
Yeah. What would you say is the highlight of your running career?
I think my college experience, to be honest. I think I really value being part of a team, and we had an amazing team, and we just did a lot of cool stuff together. So that was really special to me. And I think the second thing I would say is my marathon trials when my two daughters were there, the last one in 2020. So it's kind of fun to have my kids be there to see it.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a daughter who runs cross country and high jumps for her college's track team. So spent a lot of time watching her and traveling, although typically it's, especially for high jumping, it's not a very long experience that you're watching. Well, how has, talk more about how your relationship with running changed since retiring from professional competition. You did mention some of the work you're doing now.
Yeah, I think it's just, I still feel like I have that competitive spirit, but I really, you know, there's no pressure. It's just I'm doing it for the love of the sport. And so it's just more kind of for fun, for enjoyment, for the social connection when I'm out there running with other people. And you know, I'm still just a goal-oriented person, so it still gives me that outlet to be able to set a goal.
Somebody is wondering, why is it 26.2 miles for a marathon?
Oh, my gosh. Now you put me on the spot. There's a story behind it, and I think it's back to, you know, Athens, Greece, and the first marathon was someone running from one town to another. I don't remember the exact story, but there's like history to it, and it's from way a long time ago.
The one I heard was goes back to, I think it was around 1908, the London Olympics, and the royal family requested that the race start at Windsor Castle and finish in front of the royal box, and it was,
oh my gosh,
it was 26.2 miles. So that was a story that I heard. I guess it was varied for quite a while, and then finally they hit on, okay, we're going to stick with the what the royal family had for it. That was the story I heard. Oh, man.
I'll believe it.
I'm going to tell you a little story. I had a friend who was going to run a half marathon. So I thought, oh, at the last minute, I'll do it too. That was a huge mistake. one of these guys that gets out and does a couple, 3 miles in the morning and not really training at all. And I suffered, I think, for about the next 6 months from it. How much preparation do you need, just in terms of time, do you think you need?
I think for the marathon distance, I think a half marathon's, you know, you can kind of get away with it with a half marathon and kind of gut it out. And you'll, like you said, you'll pay for it later. But the marathon really is a whole other animal. You really do have to put the work in. So, you know, most training plans, I think they vary from like a 12-week to even a 20-week. And I would argue in favor of the longer, the better, the sooner you can start and the more time you give yourself to really adapt to the training, the better.
Yeah, probably. So about a half a year or so is, before it starts is the time to do it.
And especially if you're
go ahead.
A novice runner.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think especially if you're a novice runner, if you've got a little bit of a base underneath you, you know, you can shorten that time frame. But yeah, I agree. The newer runners definitely should consider taking like that length of time.
And I would expect probably important to check with your doctor before you even start the training.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Would you recommend that runners run shorter races before tackling a marathon?
Well, I think it can be helpful just to give you confidence and get used to the experience of being in a road race and the preparation, you know, planning what you're going to eat before and how you're going to dress. I think there's definitely value in that.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me anyway. What type of work regimen should you someone follow when training for a marathon?
In terms of like running volume?
I was thinking, yeah, you know, do you base it solely on running or do you try cross training, you know, maybe swimming or other kinds of strength training?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think if you're going to, you know, most of us have limited amounts of time in the day to fit in extra things. And I think runners are famous for just wanting to get their run in and not, you know, spend the time doing other things. But I think the highest value, you know, extra activity, in my opinion, is just getting the strength training in. Making sure your body is as durable as it can be to handle that repetition of impact that the marathon requires.
Yeah, and I'm wondering about the kind too of when you think about running. Are you running long, short, fat, flat, hilly, fast, slow, bit of everything?
I would say a bit of everything. I think a little bit depends upon the course you're training for. So, like, for example, the Boston Marathon was just a week ago, and that's a pretty hilly course. So most folks who've been fortunate enough to qualify for that race will intentionally do a lot of hill training just to prepare. But most training plans will have a mixture. Certainly that long run is really important. There's usually a weekly long run. But then the midweek runs can have, you know, some hill repeats, some shorter intervals, some variability.
Yeah. And I'm also wondering about nutrition. How does that play in marathon training and performance?
I mean, I think it starts in the training side of it and just making sure that you're fueling appropriately, replacing all those calories and getting enough of the nutrients you need during your training. And then fueling during the race is a kind of a separate challenge with this long of a distance. Most runners will practice drinking the fluids that they're going to be drinking on the course and taking the gels or whatever nutrition they're going to take during their race, during their training, just so their body, again, is getting used to that and they're kind of figuring out where their needs lie in terms of the fueling.
Yeah. And the other is sleep. Although I've done long bicycle rides, you know, where you're going a long way, and I never had any trouble getting to sleep afterwards. But how important is sleep when training?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I think we're seeing more and more that sleep really can play a role in injuries. So I think getting adequate rest is super important, especially after those big long runs, just to make sure you recover well and you don't get hurt.
It's fun talking marathons today with our guest, Janelle Deathridge, and she'll be with us right up until 12:30. Janelle's a physical therapist and former collegiate and professional runner, and we're talking about how to train to run a marathon. You can give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, and we'll be back right after this look at the news. Great to have you along today on WPR News. We're taking a look at getting ready for a marathon and maybe dealing with issues surrounding physical issues that you might have with our guest, Janelle Deathridge, physical therapist with UW Health Sports Medicine Runners Clinic. She's also a former collegiate and professional runner, talking about how to train for a marathon. And plenty of time, she's with us till 12:30, so plenty of time for your training questions. Maybe you're bouncing back from an injury. Question about that? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Cheryl from Madison called, couldn't stay with us, Janelle, and says that the cities of Athens and Marathon in Wisconsin are about 26 miles apart, and that's why they were given those names.
Ah, thank you, Cheryl. That's awesome.
I did. And Dan from Madison also couldn't stay with us but called. He said that ancient Greece, he was going back to what you were commenting on, there was a messenger who ran from Marathon to Athens to announce a victory against the Persians, and the distance he ran was roughly 26.2 miles. So,
okay.
But I'm still leaning on the royal family for the exact.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. So, do you participate now in, I mean, there's a bunch of marathons in Wisconsin. Have you ever run Grandma's?
Yeah, I've run Grandma's actually three times. That's my favorite race, definitely. But I've run several in this area, and I've run the Madison Marathon three times. So I like to stay local. It's nice to have something right in your backyard. Nice to be able to get out and actually train on the marathon course. So there's a lot of great things about running a marathon where you live. Sleep in your own bed that night. It's awesome.
Yeah, that's for sure. Somebody asked about tapering, and we do hear the term tapering when training for a competition. What is it, I guess, and if it plays a role when training for a marathon?
It's a very important part of the training, and it's typically the slow, steady decrease in overall volume and intensity of the training, just to make sure you're really well rested when you line up on the starting line the day of the race. And it usually starts between 2 and 3 weeks out from the race. Most marathon runners will do one last big long run and then slowly taper off after that. And it can be challenging a lot of times. You know, a lot of times runners are used to their running volume, and, you know, we run for a lot of different reasons outside of just training. We run for our mental health, our social connection. And so it's hard to back off. And it can be, honestly, we think about the training, the actual long runs, and, you know, things that sound kind of grueling, but to be honest, a lot of marathon runners struggle with the taper more than anything because it's really hard to back off. But it really is probably one of the most important parts of the training, is if you show up to race day and you're not well rested, you're not going to have a great race. So it's very important.
So we've trained and now we're running a marathon. What about pacing? You notice most runners are looking at their watch, or they're trying to do something while they're running. In that sense, how do you figure that out?
It can be really tricky. Most of the time, you can get an idea during your training. Typically, if you follow a training plan or work with a coach, there'll be some sort of indicator workout where you attempt to go like your goal marathon pace and get an idea of whether that's going to be reasonable or not. And I think going in with a goal pace that's a reasonable pace in mind is super important. You know, with that long of a distance, if you go out too fast, it can be a really rough day. So I think, you know, it's the length of race where you should feel very comfortable for at least the first half of it. And if you're struggling sooner than that, it's not a great thing. So just, you know, being patient when you start, know that it's a journey, and that, you know, those nerves and those jitters sometimes make you want to go out too hard, but That's where the modern day running watches that can give you some accurate information on like your pace and your pace per mile can be helpful to get you in the ballpark and make sure you're not overreaching going out too fast.
Yeah, it's. I was thinking about this. If you were going to run a marathon in 2 hours, which would be mighty fast. In fact, I think the women's record was just broken at the Chicago Marathon, which was a touch over 2 hours. But you're running 13 miles an hour.
I mean, the elite runners are running like sub 5 minute miles for the men and pretty close to it for the women. It's really incredible how fast they're going. It's pretty remarkable when you think about it. Most of us can't even, you know, run like a lap on the high school track at that pace, and they can do it for 26.2 miles. It's pretty crazy.
It's absolutely amazing. I mean, I'm on my bike and I look at 13 miles an hour and it's moving right along, you know, and then I'm thinking of running that around Lake Monona like I do with my bike. And it's just really, really hard to imagine. What are the typical, I'm trying to think of the proper, the typical medical or physical conditions, let's put it that way, the current physical problems that are most likely to develop for a marathoner?
So long-distance runners get what we call overuse injuries. So, you know, you'll hear of the occasional ankle sprain, but for the most part, our injuries are things that develop just based on the constant repetitive stress on our bodies. So we get things like tendonitis, problems that are more just due to, like, the tissue being stressed repeatedly. So we just kind of lump it into overuse injuries, but it can vary from things like Achilles tendonitis, to knee pain is common. There's a lot of different sources of knee pain, but knees are a common problem for marathon runners. And certainly hips and other like soft tissue injuries around the hip. Another common injury to distance runners is something called a bone stress injury, which is where the bone will either have an actual hairline fracture in it and develop a stress fracture, or just have some swelling and some evidence of just extra stress on it, and it can be a source of pain as well, and it can be a reason why people can't make it to the starting line, unfortunately. So when we're trying to rehab people in the clinic, you know, we're looking at all of the factors involved in these different types of injuries and what maybe led to that overuse. So it's, you know, could potentially just be that they weren't following an appropriate training plan and starting slow like we talked about before and gradually ramping things up and, you know, maybe just jumped too soon into too much training too fast. But sometimes it's what you're bringing to the table in terms of your strength or maybe your flexibility. Sometimes it's your running form. And so those are all the different things that I look at when I see runners in the clinic and that we're trying to work on and build a lot of symmetry between the right and the left side so that there's not one side that's maybe taking a little bit more of the impact force or not handling it as well as the other side.
What are specific shoes? I'm thinking about shoes. You know, for my little jogs and so forth, I love Brooks Ghost. I'm sure runners are probably not using those shoes. So what do they use?
Actually, I think that's still a super popular shoe, so you picked a good one.
Yeah, I love that shoe.
Yeah, it's really popular. The running shoes have just evolved since I've started running, and the modern running shoe looks a lot different than it did even, you know, 5-10 years ago. There's a lot of options out there, and as far as like what's the best shoe for any given person, it really just depends upon the individual. And, you know, these days we just educate people to just fit for comfort. So the most important thing is, it sounds kind of silly and really simple, but it's, you know, if the shoe feels comfortable when you put it on and you're comfortable running in it, that pretty much trumps anything, any advice anybody is giving you about them. And there's a lot of options of, you know, more cushioned shoes versus more stiff shoes, you know, shoes that have even like a fancy carbon plate in them that will, you know, potentially help you run a little bit faster. So I think the best thing for, like, especially someone looking to switch shoes or someone new to the sport, is to go to one of the local running shoe stores and really try on a wide variety of different styles and just find what fits the best and feels the best for them.
Yeah, I found the reason I like the Brooks, the Ghosts, is I can put those on and I could go a long way the first time I put them on, and I never have any, you know, there's never blistering or anything that would create a problem for me.
Yeah, I think that's super important. It should never feel like you need to break the shoe in. You should feel like you can just put it on and just go for your first run and feel great in them.
Is there anything in terms of wear, what you would wear? I mean, I look and see people are sort of all look like they're wearing about the same kind of thing.
Yeah, I think there's definitely some really nice, like, technical fabrics out there that are lightweight and you know, in the wintertime still can provide warmth, or in the summertime are nice and breathable. And I think there's a lot of, again, individual variability in terms of how, you know, people want to dress for different temperatures. And that's another thing that's great to experiment with in your training, is trying, like, different styles of clothing in different, you know, depending upon the weather, like different amounts of layers, if it's going to be a cold race. But yeah, absolutely. Like, finding clothes that are running specific can be really helpful to make you comfortable out there.
And I'm wondering about hydration too. You know, when you're biking 80 or 100 miles, typically the advice I was always given first is drink before you're thirsty. And I'm wondering, if that applies to a marathon runner?
That's actually a great question. And I think we're, you know, the science has evolved when it comes to hydration during marathons. I think definitely managing your thirst is really important, because as soon as your brain senses that thirst, it potentially can kind of start to shut you off, shut you down, and like force you to run slower. So definitely managing your thirst is huge. And I think, depending upon the weather day you're going to have, you know, if you're running a race like the Madison Marathon that's in November, you're probably not going to be sweating a lot. You might get away with not drinking as much and maybe not starting as early. Like, maybe you skip the first water stop or two. But if it's going to be a race like Grandma's Marathon that you mentioned, which is in June, potentially much warmer, then I think it makes more sense to start earlier in the run and to, like, kind of you mentioned, to stay ahead of it a little bit, just so you don't get to the point where you're so thirsty you just can't catch up. And, you know, most of the bigger races have plenty of stops out on the course. And there's also great products. You can wear your water in a, like a belt or in a backpack if you feel more comfortable just having it with you, or your whatever you're going to drink, your, you know, Gatorade or something similar.
Yeah. Another emailer wonders what you suggest for chafing. That's a lot of skin-on-skin contact.
There's lots of different products out there, but something simple like an Aquaphor, you know, like a petroleum jelly-based product like an Aquaphor, I think is a great product that works for that. And I think just making sure, like, the clothing matters too. So, I you know, steering clear of things like cotton. Again, back to the, like, technical fabrics, some of the little bit nicer running specific fabrics are designed to minimize chafing. So making sure that you're looking for things that are designed for runners can be helpful too.
And someone else is wondering about apps. Are there any good apps or other technology you recommend to use during training or a race to track progress and goals?
There's lots of different things out there. A lot of folks wear GPS watches. My watch of choice, and a lot of runners wear Garmin watches, and they have a great app that, like, I don't even have to load it on. It just automatically goes from my watch to the app or to my computer, and it just tracks for me. And it'll, you know, let you know your splits for your run, the elevation change. The watches these days will give you all sorts of feedback on heart rate and, you know, ideas for how long you'll need to recover from that run. So if you're using a running specific watch, there's a lot of data that you can get from it. some of it may be more accurate than others, but it is nice to have the pace, the elevation change, you know, those sorts of things will be loaded into the app off your watch. And then as far as apps for training, I'm not super familiar with like different specific marathon training plans that are in app form, but I think like one of the most popular marathon training plans are the Hal Higdon plans. That training group training plan has several different variations. There's like a novice version all the way up to a little bit more advanced where you'd be doing harder workouts and more mileage. So no matter what you're using, I think the most important thing is that it fits with where you are in your running journey. Again, like if you're a novice, you want to make sure that you're really following a novice training plan, just to make sure that you aren't putting yourself at risk for getting injured.
Yeah. I use MapMyRun, that app, and I like it a lot. Mostly, yeah. It mostly keeps me honest and keeps me kind of motivated to stay in the top 6-7% of all the people on it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people use Strava. I'm not on that, but that's another like really super popular kind of app to stay connected with other runners, and you can do like little competitions, and so I'm sure there's more out there. But
Pat emailed, how do you not get bored running the long distances? How do you mentally prepare for these types of events and during the events?
That's a great question. Everybody kind of has their thing. Like I know plenty of folks who are just, you know, they don't want to listen to any music. They don't want any distractions. They just kind of use that time to clear their head. It's sort of their like mental therapy, which I respect. And there's days where I just turn off my earbuds and I just, you know, kind of zone out and think about the day. And I use the time for that, but I'm a big fan of podcasts. So I listen to a lot of podcasts when I run. I love running with other people, and some of my, you know, current and former training partners are some of my best friends to this day, because you just have so much time to talk and learn about each other's lives and just get to know people. So it's really awesome. There's a lot of great training groups locally. So if you're looking for ways to stay motivated and make it fun and interesting, I think joining a training group, there's training groups out there for all abilities. But yes, podcasts are my go-to, I guess.
What clues does your body give you during training or a race that tell you something's wrong?
I think it's really important to listen to your body in terms of really specific pain. I mean, for sure, when you're training for a marathon, you're going to have days where things are just uncomfortable and you're going to have muscle soreness. I think being able to differentiate between, is this an okay pain? And is this just sort of normal training? And is this something that it indicates that I might need to take a few days off and back off? And my general rule is, you know, you shouldn't really be running with pain. Like if it's maybe like we use that 0 to 10 pain scale quite a bit in our world. And I think if it's living in like the 1 or 2 range, and it's not affecting how you're running. So if you're not limping, you're not favoring one side or the other because of it, and you can kind of ignore it, and it's not getting worse while you're out there or lingering when you're done, I think that's probably okay. I get more nervous, and I usually recommend like some extra days off if there's pain that's sharp, if the pain is progressively getting worse while you're running, or if it's lingering when you're done for longer than like an hour or two, more than just like a normal, you know, and it's more than just a more normal muscle soreness.
Yeah, makes sense. What's a time goal? Say you're going to run your first marathon. Is the goal just to finish, or what's a time goal for finishing your first marathon?
To be honest, I feel like no matter where you are, even if you're an elite marathon runner, the goal should always be to finish, because there's no guarantees in that long of a race. And I've definitely seen things go south for even like the best runners. So I think my thought is always to have more than one goal. You know, you kind of have everyone's goal should just be to get to the finish line, right? So that's goal number one. And then you kind of have your, if it's a perfect day goal, and there's so many things that can affect that long of a race, including weather, you know, diets, like were you sick 2 weeks before? There's all sorts of things. So kind of having your, if everything goes perfectly, goal, and then kind of having your, like, I would be okay with it, like, it's still a good day kind of goal. So having, like, different goals, that way, like, you know what, if you just made it to the finish line, you still achieved one of your goals. That's awesome.
Yeah, for sure. And how long do you let your body recover, or how long does it take to recover after a marathon?
You know, I think we underestimate this, and I don't have a statistic on this. This is just my feeling from having done this for a lot of years. I see probably just as many people get injured in the month after the marathon than I do leading up to it. And I think it's because we really underestimate how much time we need to truly recover. And we start training maybe too hard too soon. You know, we're coming off that taper, and then we have this one big event, and we're just like, we've tapered for those 2 to 3 weeks, and we're like, I want to get back into my training regimen right away. So I really recommend, like, at least a good couple of weeks of just shutting down, just taking some walks, taking some bike rides, and then ramping back up slowly like you did at the start of your training cycle versus going right back at it.
And on that note, we are out of time. Janelle, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And hopefully we'll look forward to another visit down the road. Thanks, Janelle.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Janelle Dethridge with us. She's a physical therapist with the UW Health Sports Medicine Runners Club. Fun talking with her about getting ready and running a marathon. Well, what about the weather? Are you ready for a talk about the weather? John Martin, our weather guy, is coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at weather and climate with our guest, one of our weather guys with us today, John Martin, professor, former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us. And if you have a weather or climate question, I hope you'll join in for this last half hour. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. John Martin, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Good.
Steve Ackerman is under the weather a little bit
yes,
today.
Yes, he is.
So you've got it for a half hour. Precipitation, let's talk about that just to begin with. Last May was the 10th wettest on record in Wisconsin. We had an average of more than 5.5 inches of precip falling statewide last May.
Yeah.
How likely is it we'll see that again?
Well, I don't think I've seen any forecast from the Climate Prediction Center that zeroes in on that in terms of saying, you know, we're going to have a repeat of May and June. To remind people, June last year was even worse in terms of being wet here in Dane County. So there's no apparent forecast for that to be repeated this year. But I don't know if that's, you know, going to be the way that it turns out. You can get thunderstorm activity can just give you a huge amount of rain, even though it's really hard to predict even hours in advance.
Yeah. Robert had sent us an email. He cites a Washington Post article that this has been the windiest spring in 50 years. Mm. He wondered if you have any thoughts on that.
Well, it's a really interesting phenomena that you can measure that, and it's verifiable to measure that. And my colleague Andrea Lang and myself have tried, now we're trying for the third time with National Science Foundation on a proposal to investigate the transition, interannual variability of the transition from winter to spring. And this is exactly the kind of thing that we're interested in trying to understand better. How do you go from one year to the next where you get such, you know, large differences between the windiness and then that's pollen transport in April, in a windy April. And so that does something to the flora and fauna. So it's a really interesting question with lots of dimensions. And how do we transition from winter to spring from one year to the next, and why is it different?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, wind makes me think about tornadoes.
Yeah, oh, gee.
Last May was a busy month in Wisconsin for tornadoes. I think it was 22 of the state's 24 tornadoes happened during May.
Yeah, yeah. It was a weird May last year, as you pointed out, first with the precipitation. Because, you know, one of the things that characterized May last year was an abundance of thunderstorms. We didn't get any tornadic storms, I don't think, in Dane County, or at least not in Madison last May. But we did have a lot of thunder. It seemed like a really early start to the thunder season for us. And, again, whether or not that's repeated this year or not is just hard to say. And apparently no obvious factors pointing towards that in the current forecast.
It does seem to me, at least, that tornado activity, if you look at the nation, it's shifting a little bit. There seems to be a lot more tornadic activity on the east, along the east coast and southeast.
Well, Victor Gensini down in Northern Illinois University, in collaboration with Harold Brooks, I think, at the Storm Prediction Center, they did a really interesting study that I'm not going to get the year right, but it's not that old, where they found clear evidence that Tornado Alley, the frequency maximum region in the central plains of the U.S., south central plains, has moved slightly eastward and moved up in the calendar year a little bit. So there are some changes that are going on with the main tornadic activity. But then, as you point out, stuff on the periphery, east coast tornadoes and whatnot, are a lot more rare. But they're becoming, apparently, increasingly common. And that is fairly interesting and not quite well explained or understood yet.
Yeah, I know the National Weather Service reported last year that there were 552 tornadoes nationwide. Mm. And usually by the end of April, that was as of last week, that there had already been. Mm. And usually by the end of April, there's about 330.
Yeah, and part of the interesting thing about tornadic activity in the United States is that it comes in different regions in different seasons. February and March are sort of peak times for the southeast United States, the Carolinas, Georgia, parts of Mississippi, and Alabama. And then it moves to the Central Plains or thereabouts in April and May, and then moves toward the Great Lakes and, southern Great Lakes, western Great Lakes, until in June and July. So there are different foci across the country at different times of the year. So if one gets a head start, then the whole count for the season for the whole country has gone way up. And I don't know whether or not there was a, unusually large number in the southeast. I know Arkansas got hit fairly badly over the month of March, which is a little bit unusual for them. It's more east of them usually that happens. So little things around the edge can get you going in a direction that leads to a big rally in the numbers by the end of April.
Cater, I think it is, in Herbster.
Yeah, hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
The bizarre snowfall last winter. I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts about the bigger system causes of that, like the jet stream and climate change. I mean, what happened there?
A lack of snow you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not just a lack. It's a good question. It's not just a lack of snow. It's a lack of precipitation. We were about average for the wintertime, I guess, in precipitation, but most of it was in the rain, form of rain. So underlying that is probably the fact that we were, warmer than normal for extended periods of time, and that's not hard to imagine being tied to changes in the climate, because that'll generally be the case. We'll have a bias toward being a little warmer than normal. But we were sufficiently warmer than normal to miss out on some of those precipitation events being snow as opposed to being rain. And so that's local to last year. That's not just climate change. There's something strange about the nature of the storm track that kept us on the warm side of too many of those events. We didn't get our fair share of the colder ones. And there was no obvious thing that I noticed as it was happening in the circulation over North America that would have led to that. But, these are the kind of things that are more easily detected and probably better investigated in their aftermath than they are as they're occurring. So maybe over the summertime, among the things that I get to do finally when I'm free to think every day, 5 days a week, looking at things exactly like that are a personal interest of mine, and I really do like to follow up and figure out what might have happened circulation-wise, broad-scale circulation, as you point out, over last winter.
Yeah, maybe something we can talk about by the end of summer.
Yeah, could be. Could be.
Thank you for calling. Willem in Colfax, your turn. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I was just wondering about your opinion about these cuts to the National Weather Service and how that might affect, early warning systems or more regional radar, and also the current administration's climate change denial. The President Trump calls it a hoax. I wonder how that affects the funding for research and how that might, the future of climate study and the Weather Service.
Yeah, good questions and important questions of the day. The cuts that have been recklessly and thoughtlessly done to the NOAA and especially to the National Weather Service have put us as a nation in a position where we are not ready for the severe weather season, which includes the tornado season. And as Larry and I were just talking about, that migrates from one region to the next across the country over the next 6 months. And we're not ready for the hurricane season, because there'll be information that we need that is now no longer quite at our fingertips as it was before, that will inform hurricane prediction, both intensity, severity, and location of impact. So these are all negative consequences of a reckless and poorly thought out, absolutely lacking any analysis of trying to make changes at NOAA or more specifically the Weather Service. And I don't want to come across as sounding like someone who doesn't think that it's important to constantly revise and review programs and operations in some of these big organizations. That's perfectly legitimate concern and a legitimate activity to engage in. What isn't legitimate is doing it without any analysis at all and simply running in with a hatchet and cutting things to pieces and then throwing away what you consider the debris. That's going to cost lives across our country. There's no question about it. It's only a matter of when and where. It's going to cost lives. And then on the longer term, making, ridiculous statements to the effect that the climate change and climate science predictions about what's going to happen in the future are a hoax, it's nonsensical. This is coming from a guy who doesn't know how to put in a good day's work on any problem. He never has demonstrated that. He certainly isn't demonstrating it now. Anything that requires work, analysis, or any real significant effort is not something he's interested in. And so it's easy to just call it a hoax. The problem is it's not a hoax, and the real world is going to intervene in ways that will make itself quite well known, and that's going to impact Americans for the next 50 years in ways that we were beginning to start to pull back on. And now we're going to have a period of time where all of those efforts are going to be have gone for naught for a period of time. And the problem with the climate issue is that it's the integrated result of treating our environment in a certain way, either with a lack of respect, which I think we're in now, or with a certain sort of respect, pressured by our interests in making sure we can continue to make a living and have a lifestyle. That was a better way to do it than what we're doing now, which is absolutely no regard at all for the environment. And it's going to come back and bite us. There's no doubt about it.
John Martin, our guest today, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Our guest, you can join in with your questions or comments. The number, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're talking climate and weather today with one of our weather guys, John Martin, from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John, we had a question about vapor pressure. Talking about rising temperatures and precipitation makes you think about humidity. And this person wonders, how is humidity measured and how does humidity relate to vapor pressure?
Yeah, there's a number of ways to measure the amount of water vapor that's in the air. That's invisible water gas. You can't see it any more than you can see oxygen or nitrogen. It's invisible. And there's a number of ways to measure it. One of those ways is to take a sample of air into the lab and actually weigh the water vapor molecules and figure out what the ratio of their mass to the rest of the mass of the air parcel is, and that's called the mixing ratio. Another way, though, is to figure out how much pressure is exerted just by the water vapor molecules in the sample, because it's made up, the sample will be made up of nitrogen, oxygen, water vapor, carbon dioxide, a whole bunch of different chemicals. The air is a mixture on our planet. And you can, I don't know how, I'm not a chemist, but you can go in and figure out what fraction of that total pressure is exerted by those water vapor molecules. And that fraction is called the vapor pressure. And so that, it's one really thinks about it most frequently in meteorological terms as a means to measure the water vapor content. And if you know that the air is saturated with respect to water, that is, you can't stuff another water vapor molecule into it without condensing one out, then the pressure exerted by that collection of water vapor molecules is called the saturation vapor pressure. That depends only on the temperature. So that's pretty wild. It's very cool. And it affords us some really interesting ways to and informative ways to measure the humidity.
Oh, really interesting. Yeah. Julian Findelak has something for us. Let's go there.
Hi there. Thanks for the program, as always. Just wanted to say a very sincere thank you to your guests for their response regarding federal budget cuts to NOAA and the National Weather Service. I really appreciate the thoughtful and comprehensive response. I think it's rare now that really people are willing to say the truth and say what's in front of us so that we all can really take it in. And one thing I wondered is I didn't hear if his response included ramifications in terms of farmers and how they use the Weather Service for benefits in their work.
Hmm. Yeah, it's an excellent point. It's an absolutely excellent point. The notion that farmers wanting to know about soil moisture, they have the U.S. Drought Monitor is tied to NOAA and it's tied to the Weather Service, and any cuts that are made to that it at a minimum reduces the amount of information transfer between individual farmers, large farms or small, and important weather information. And I know that when you're, cutting hay or cutting grass or whatever it is on the farm, you need to have a reasonably accurate two-day forecast to make sure you know when to do it, or there's a lot at risk. And the idea that we're taking fewer observations than we used to for no reason at all, except to say that we're slashing budgets to satisfy somebody's whim, is not an effective way to inform our economy and to support it.
Julie, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Sherry in Townsend next. Hi, Sherry.
Hi. I'm wondering how jet streams can affect our climate and if they could be actually used to manipulate the weather.
Yeah, the jet stream is a really important weather-producing phenomenon in the middle latitudes of the Earth, where we live in places further north in our hemisphere. And It has undulations, that is, ups and downs, peaks and valleys, I guess we call them ridges and troughs on horizontal maps, across the entire hemisphere. And those are highly variable, but the position of troughs and ridges affects the position of surface low-pressure systems, which bring clouds, precipitation, and in the wintertime, snowstorms, and regions of surface high pressure, which often are associated with clear skies. In the summertime, beautiful weather. In the wintertime, sometimes some of the coldest weather that we can get are associated with them. The jet is at about 6 miles above the ground, and its position is controlled on the broadest possible scale by the temperature difference between the North Pole and the equator, which is always colder to the north. And so the jet is always moving from west to east or some fraction thereof. Trying to manipulate the jet stream is something I've not heard very much discussion about, and I think it's because people realize that the way in which the jet evolves, it combines not only responses to large-scale weather systems in the subtropics and the tropics, even though the jet doesn't migrate there, but it responds to weather systems that are produced there, hurricanes, tropical storms, and tropical convective clusters, which don't maybe mature into tropical storms. In addition, the jet can evolve due to some internal dynamics over which we have little or no control. And so trying to harness the jet and make it do what we want seems to me to be a hopeless problem. Using it to better observe the atmosphere is another matter. You can put little blimps up into the jet stream, have them reside at a certain pressure level, and circumnavigate the globe, taking periodic measurements that we wouldn't otherwise have. That's a valuable way to take advantage of the presence and undulations of the jet stream. But the other one is be great if we could do it, but we can't. It's too large scale and way too powerful.
Oh, there we go. Thank you, Sherry, for calling. Dean in Evergreen, Colorado, your turn. Hi, Dean.
Hi, good afternoon. And thanks for putting on the show. I always appreciate it every last Monday of the month. I spent my career as a research meteorologist, and I was just wondering what John's finger on the pulse might be for the new crop of grad and undergrad students in view of what's going on. I know that the federal government is a major employer for research meteorologists. Whether that's sort of having a noticeable, character in terms of how your students are looking at things there for going forward.
Yeah, I think currently there's a lot of discouragement among our student body, and I try to rally them to the realization that whatever is going on now has a limit. It has a fuse that's going to burn out. It can't go beyond 2028, and the country will realize how many terrible mistakes have already been made in terms of providing services to people with respect to the weather and climate. And the country will not tolerate the continuance of that willful ignorance. And that's my sense. And I try to instill that and convince my students of that, so that what they should be focusing on, I've been telling them this a lot this year, and I don't like to have to burden them with extra things, but I like to tell them, your job is to become excellent. At the University of Wisconsin, we can help you do that. And you must keep your head down, and we'll get our way out of this this period of darkness. And when we do, there's going to be a tremendous need for your expertise and your knowledge and your training. So try and think of this as a dark cocoon and just keep on working hard, and we'll help you do that. So I'm hoping I'm winning their hearts and their minds to that view, but I can't tell. It's only been a few months, less than 100 days.
Dean, there you go. Thank you for calling. Jerry in Kokana, let's go to you next. Hi, Jerry.
Hello, and thanks, John. I really, really appreciate it, and encourage people to call their congressmen and let them know their feelings. But my question is, because of the storms today, is there any apps that you use on your phone to be alerted for, like, a tornado or something?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't really use anything that other people don't use. I don't have any particular insights that way. I'm not a particularly tech-oriented guy. But I do look at my department's website for its depiction of, on various different regional scales, the reflectivity from the radar. So that's something that I do like to pay attention to on days like today. If I were in the La Crosse area, especially later this afternoon, I'd be thinking about looking at some form of the radar reflectivity just to make sure I saw what was coming along. And then I think the other thing is to just pay attention to the National Weather Service website pages, either at La Crosse or Milwaukee or Green Bay in our state, because they're going to be updating as soon as they can with information about, warnings and all kinds of other information about where you might go if you're in a various location as the severe weather bears down on us. So thank God that the Weather Service websites are still up and running, and I think on days like today especially, they're going to be at their full capacity trying to alert the public.
Jerry, thank you for calling. Arcelli in Madison, will go to you next. Hi.
Yes, hi. I was really enjoying this conversation, and thank you so much for your guest. When you're talking about climate change, and, who would be the most vulnerable populations that will be affected by the climate change? We oftentimes hear this word of environmental racism, et cetera, and I don't feel like people really understand why we say those words. And so if your guest could possibly break down that, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know a little bit about that, and I have a couple of examples in mind. One thing one can say is that one of the elements of climate change is that the ice in the high latitudes, both of the northern and southern hemisphere, is melting at a greater rate than it used to. And so that tends to raise sea levels. The water just can't disappear from the face of the earth. It doesn't disappear and not affect sea levels. So there are many nations, island nations in the Pacific, for instance, that are seeing the shoreline encroach upon their land. And, these are not often the biggest countries, but they're countries where people are living and have lived for centuries. And they're starting to see an erosion of the arable land and actually the solid earth that on which they can continue to have their families thrive. So that's one place. They don't have a lot of political clout because they're small countries and they're not particularly wealthy countries. So that's clearly an example of, you know, an imposition being put upon them by industrialized nations that they cannot fight politically or economically. Other examples, maybe not directly related to the climate, are examples of the so-called Black Belt in Mississippi and Alabama, where the soil is extraordinarily fertile. This is a place where a lot of former slaves became farmers in that part of those two states. And when the argument was made about where to put the Doppler radar sites across Alabama and Mississippi, the political influences at the time kept those locations from being well covered by the Doppler radar. So they're among the worst places to get warnings about tornadoes and other severe weather in the spring. And there's, you know, thousands of farmers trying to make a living there. They need that information as much as anyone else. So when decisions are made that marginalize a community for whatever the reason is, in that case, it was, you know, longstanding racism in the South, that you end up putting people at risk to changes that are occurring in the environment or even regular run-of-the-mill activities of the environment, like tornadic activity in the South. But if it gets more frequent and more vicious, then the deficit of information becomes more critical. And so there's all kinds of things like that that we need to pay attention to make sure that as we plan for the future of a different climate system, we're making sure that we are accounting for all of the possible shortcomings that we've had in the past.
Thank you very much for that question. I wanted to mention climate centers for just a minute, because four of the six regional climate centers in the nation were shut down earlier this month, then including the Midwest Center, which covers Wisconsin. But they reopened about a week later and are set to renew their contracts with NOAA in June. What do these climate centers do, and what do they do, and what do you make of the reopening?
Yeah, the reopening is the flip side of the reckless closing. So, you know, and realizing almost immediately that was a very stupid and poorly thought out move. The Midwest Climate Center monitors soil moisture, among other things. It has a direct interaction with the Illinois Water Survey, which does a tremendous job about agricultural interest in both Illinois and southern Wisconsin, maybe even more than southern Wisconsin. But the Midwest Climate Center is an excellent organization that is, as you say, Larry, tied to NOAA, and provides really a wealth, I can't even describe how much, a wealth of information for the agricultural world as well as public interest in weather and climate. So it's extremely important, and I'm so glad that they were quickly brought back online, because this summer would have been, their absence would have been felt critically this summer if that was not online for a variety of reasons, maybe most of them being agricultural reasons.
NOAA announced this month that the world's coral reefs are in the midst of the largest global bleaching event on record. Can you explain in a minute or so what that means and why we think it's occurring?
I wish I knew for sure. I'm going to say what I think is the case, but I'm not sure that I'm right. I think as the carbon dioxide fraction, dissolved carbon dioxide fraction in water, the seawater goes up, because the carbon dioxide fraction in the atmosphere goes up, it acidifies the ocean water, and that is very bad for coral. And I think that, and coral's a living organism. And so when it gets bleached, it's not just changing the color of what you see as a piece of rock, you know, ancient coral at a gift shop. It's killing organisms that provide a tremendous service by filtering the water that's in and around fishing areas and also close to land masses. And so this is a really critical part of the ecosystem in ways I can't describe with any intelligence. But we're killing a living organism that plays that critical cornerstone role in large-scale ecosystems around the globe in the oceans. And so it's not a good thing. And it's a function of carbon dioxide fraction.
On that note, John, we are out of time. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I appreciate it. We'll get you
great
for
to be
the
here.
Last Monday of next month.
All right. Great to be here.
John Martin, professor and former chair of and current member of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. And thank you for listening today, and thanks to our team today. Clara Neipert, Joel Patnott, our producers, technical directors Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, who also produces shows like this one. Our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.